Now, I should warn you, Robin, that you have been shortchanged on the chair. That I have this.
Going to get the posh one.
I've got this huge, grandiose, over-the-top chair, and you've got some IKEA kind of dining room chair, which I think is very unfair, and I'm sorry for you for that.
But I don't mind because this doesn't freak me out at all. So.
No, oh, lucky you.
We're even.
I'll sit here feeling nervous all evening. All right, so we had a nice little chat downstairs and probably talked about all the things we're now going to talk about on the stage.
I've got a sore throat now just from talking
about that. Well, I have that effect on people. So what was really interesting with chatting with you downstairs was a bit of your background, really, how you got into all of this and what it is that you do now. Because a lot of these people might not know you, might not know what you do and how you're involved in the web. So give us a little summary so that people can kind of know where you come from.
Okie dokie. So I could see when I was born, and my vision just very gradually degenerated, which made it extremely easy to adjust. And the rest of my family have got a vision impairment as well. My mum can't see at all. My two sisters can't see. My dad's registered blind, although he has actually got quite good vision. But so it was very normal.
Mm-hmm.
And after university, I did engineering and realised that I probably would find it quite difficult to build bridges and stuff like that. So I went into IT as a learner of IT, because this was prior to things being able to talk. There wasn't any talking computers or anything like that. So I went to the RNIB down. There was a residential centre where you could go for 3 months, they paid at that time. That's long gone. To learn IT. And actually, I must have been quite adept at getting to grips with this technology business, because they actually hired me after that to be an IT instructor.
Okay.
So 3 months from zero to being able to teach other people. So I worked there for a couple of years until they closed the place down, which mm-hmm. is a shame, because it was an absolutely fantastic venue and did a lot of good for a lot of people. But then, luckily, AbilityNet, I don't know if people are familiar, but AbilityNet are the UK's leading experts of technology and disability. We're actually the only pan-disability organisation out there. So we're the go-to organisation to for any kind of technology and special extreme usability, let's call it.
I love that, extreme usability.
for people with the full gamut of impairments. And luckily, yeah, so they were hiring straight after this place closed. So I went straight into there in 96, and this was at the time when they were wondering whether they should even have a website. So we were kind of a bit late on the curve, but I persuaded them that they should do. And a few years later, I was, myself and a team were delivering web consultancy. Mm-hmm. But as I was saying to you earlier, actually in the last few years, every organization has got a website, and a lot of the organizations that we've worked with, we've actually worked with for several years. And so they've kind of moved on to the mobile space. And so actually more of what we do now, particularly with the existing customers, is mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly mobile dev rather than mobile web.
Yeah.
But we absolutely do deal with both desktop and web and mobile web issues as well.
Right. One of the things you said to me, which I found quite a shocking statement, was that as web designers, we shouldn't be building websites for disabled people, right? And immediately, well, that's a strange thing for someone to say that works in the accessibility field. What do you mean by that? Where are you coming from when you say that?
So everyone knows about accessibility, right? Everyone knows about WCAG. Everyone knows about making sure that your websites are accessible. So what do? Well, you have all of these common practices over here about how you build websites, the tools that you use, the budget that you assign to it, the people that you get involved, the processes, the stages that you go through, and then you layer on top WCAG, or testing with the keyboard, that sort of thing, as this additional task in your to-do list.
Mm-hmm.
And you assign it separate budget in some cases, or additional budget, etc. That's absolutely the wrong approach.
Right.
So 10 years ago, for example, when the web first came out, if you didn't have a text-only version on your website, then you weren't catering for disabled people. blind people needed a text-only version, and so the BBC had Betsy and stuff like that, and it was a complete disaster. And we were in a sort of a ghetto situation where disabled people, you know, given these alternative accessible versions, because the main site definitely wasn't, were getting like the poorer cousin alternative. You know, it's a fraction of the content and functionality of the main site, hardly ever updated, you know, a real sort of second-class experience.
Yeah.
We've come full circle now. So nowadays, your main site should be inclusive. And inclusive is the sort of word that we would use these days, inclusive design. So if you've got, if you need to bolt on an accessible version, call it text-only or whatever it is, then, you know, that's kind of a public admission that you've screwed up the accessibility of your site. So it's not about designing for disabled people in as much as doing what you do and then think about how you're going to make it accessible, how are you going to bolt on accessibility. It's much more about everything that you do, right from proof of concept, design, wireframe mockups, right through to UAT. At every stage, have a sort of a diverse persona approach. So we all use personas. They've got a, you know, carefully crafted range of demographics, et cetera, to cater for the stakeholders that we're designing for. Where's the disability threaded throughout every one of those personas? Where's the dyslexia? Where's the age-related condition?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So we would advocate a diverse persona approach, which would inform your thinking right from square one. It would inform your choice of tools, your choice of skill sets, the decisions that you make. And if accessibility isn't bolted on, then it can't be dropped off.
Yeah.
If you haven't got budget for accessibility on this particular project or marketing campaign or wherever it might be, then you know, because it's this additional thing, then it won't go to market without accessibility being done because, oh, we couldn't afford accessibility that time or whatever. It's only, you know, it's only going to be up, it's only a flash ad that's going to be out there for 9 weeks or something. Having said that, at Ability Net, we're real pragmatists. So if you've got some inaccessible content, we wouldn't say pull it down. Let's look at your site, let's look at your mobile apps or whatever it might be, or your customer channels, and let's prioritize, let's see where your highest traffic is, let's see which are perhaps most relevant services to the sort of stakeholders that have impairments, and let's prioritize and kind of get a roadmap to achieving full compliance, however far down the line, and set achievable milestones across that. And from a sort of a, because obviously it's a legal requirement, from a legal sort of risk mitigation point of view, even if you do have inaccessibility today, even quite rampant inaccessibility in your content, having this roadmap, knowing where you stand, having identified and well-resourced sort of milestones to eventual compliance and inclusiveness would be a very useful document and a very strong position to be in. So yeah.
Okay. Well, what I liked there that you said is about having a diverse set of personas and having, you know, those different quirks that we almost all have. We all have something, you know, whether it be dyslexia, whether it be slightly poor vision, whether it be, you know, a motor skill problem as you get older. There are all of these kinds of different issues that people struggle with. What was the term that you said they use in America to describe people that didn't have disability? What was the term used?
So yeah, the disabled community, I don't know how widespread it is, but they refer to the able-bodied as TABS, temporarily able-bodied, because it'll get you all in the end, you know. And we do see that, you know, it's an aging population, and I think it's one in five people of working age, you know, between 16 and 70 or whatever it is now, will acquire a disability. And obviously the older, you know, the higher you go, the much more prevalent disability is, or impairment of some kind. And we really can't ignore this broad audience that we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
And if you factor into it, you know, all of the mobile computing and even wearable technology, which we're very much into as well, people are, to a greater or lesser extent, disabled, or their senses are disabled temporarily in the environment that you're in. You know, when you're driving, we're all visually impaired in as much as we can't text on the screen, we can't, you know, play, cut the rope, whatever it is, while we're driving. So that, you know, that's why Siri talks to us. That's why you've got these apps where, with, you know, steering wheel button integration, where you can Bluetooth connect to your device and send texts and have them spoken back to you. And when that works for people who are temporarily visually impaired, then that device, like the iPhone, is going to absolutely be revolutionary. It's going to transform the lives of people who are permanently visually impaired.
Yeah.
And similarly, you know, you're temporarily mobility impaired or dexterity impaired. When you can't operate your device because you're jogging, it's in your pocket, or you're driving, or whatever it might be. And hence being able to interact with it in a range of different ways. Voice control is the obvious one that you can think about. But having a Bluetooth keyboard attached to it for people who aren't able to touch the screen, for example, or want to be more productive. 90% of the time, these are aimed at mainstream requirements, average users who are just wanting choice, but those are really opening doors for the disabled community as well.
I mean, I thought I was an Apple fanboy until I spoke to you earlier. Wow, do you love Apple? What? I mean, yeah. What is it about? You mentioned the iPhone then, didn't you? What is it about Apple that they're doing it so right? What is it that excites you?
I know that there are a lot of Apple fans out there, but believe me, the love that's coming off the disabled community for Apple is tangible. Is there any water?
Yeah, sure. There's water on the table beside you here, this side.
Oh, sorry.
There you go.
Thanks for that.
Okay.
And the reason being because, you know, they haven't bolted on accessibility. We were talking about kind of an afterthought. If they had, then VoiceOver, the screen reader on the iPhone would just be this, you know, half-hearted.
Default language, British English.
I don't know if you can.
Dropbox. Contacts.
So this is the. I'll slow it down a bit.
Messages. Nav folder. Photography folder. Social folder. 31 new items. 9 apps.
I don't think there's
don't
any.
Open.
Oh. Is there any. I don't know if I've got the screen.
You have screen got the screen on, but why would you?
Screen curtain on.
Okay, so I wouldn't have the screen on, so double my battery life right there.
That's you.
And everything speaks, okay? This is not an afterthought. The built-in camera app, you might think, well, there's one thing
why
that a blind person...
Why would you want a camera app? I'm sorry. How
to take photos?
Take pictures?
Okay, the obvious answer is to take photos. Why wouldn't we want to take a photo if everybody else can? Well, and yeah. If it detects that VoiceOver, which is the screen reader, is running, then if I point it at someone, it'll say one voice... it'll say one face, top left.
No.
It uses the face recognition that it uses to autofocus, so I know, and it'll say center, and then I know I can take the photograph.
Okay, I've got one. The Maps app. You can't possibly use the Maps app.
Absolutely. That was a plan, because I told him downstairs.
Yeah.
So
I'm not as stupid as I look, although it surprised me downstairs. Listen to this, it's incredible. Go on.
Okay, so when Google Maps were part of iOS, it didn't do it. When they kicked Google out because they want to sort of sever their all ties with Google, Apple Maps came in, obviously slated because it was taking people out into the desert in Australia and stranding them there. But you will hear nothing bad about it from the disabled, well, from the blind community. I can put my finger on the screen and I can trace roads. And depending on the sound, if I stay on the road, it'll say donk, donk, donk. If I go off, it'll go do, 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 do. So I go back on the road. It'll tell me I'm on the, you know, Wathen Road or something. East-West Road, I drag my finger along, it'll say approaching junction with Littleton Road, North-South Road. It'll tell me entering Littleton Road, North-South Road, and then I can start going that way. You can explore your environment. So every aspect of inclusion is hard-baked into the device. So whether you're designing a website, or a mobile website, or a mobile app, or a device, whatever it might be, if you keep with this diverse persona approach, then you will consider, well, okay, how would it work for this person? Because if you get, you know, I can guarantee you that if you think about you know, somebody with a vision impairment, you will be catering for people who are temporarily visually impaired or who are halfway there or whatever it might be because of age. So, and we are getting to this, and it's purely driven by this mainstream need for sort of flexible mobile computing, you know, driven by the smartphone. So just to kind of finish off the analogy, so because this device is so inclusive, everything in it is accessible to me. And because of the app sort of ecosystem and the fact that the SDK, that so it's not only the OS that's totally inclusive, the SDK means that if you just do the out-of-the-box stuff, follow the directions, you know, follow the recipe, you will have accessible apps. obviously not, you know, shoot 'em ups and stuff like that for someone like myself, but every control, every function, etc. And hence, it's a completely inclusive experience, and it will be my go-to option compared to a website where there is 5,000% more data that I have to plow through. However nicely the headings are hierarchied and everything, you know, it's going to be so much better to have a stripped-down experience. And before web app, mobile apps came along, disabled people, particularly visually impaired people, were going to m.google or whatever it might be, or m.ebay.co.uk/mobile, because you get the same very cut-down experience. And because platforms back then, you couldn't rely on them, you know, supporting Ajax or Flash, you got rid of all that as well. I'm not saying that Ajax is evil. Flash is evil, by the way. But I'm not saying that, no, actually, you can do Flash really quite well. But it's certainly, you know, HTML5 is opening new doors for accessibility, which Flash has made it very difficult to open in the past. But, you know, because the browsers didn't support these things, this is mainstream browsers on, you know, Symbian phones and stuff like that, then M. whatever it might be was giving you a much cleaner, much more responsive, a much more sort of inclusive experience.
Now, there's an interesting thing you just said there, because you were saying that one of the reasons you like mobile sites is because it was stripped down and it was, you know, it was much more focused in what it had and it didn't load all the stuff that you didn't need. Where does that leave us with responsive design then? Because responsive design, one of the things that we, you know, people like Jeremy, you know, would be saying is that you shouldn't be stripping out content that you give to the main site. You know, that you should be serving up similar content on the mobile, to the mobile devices. Do you actually prefer a stripped down, separate mobile site to something that's responsive, or doesn't it make any difference?
Obviously, there are a full range of opinions here, and we wouldn't advocate having a mobile version necessarily,
right,
if the main version ticks enough of the boxes. Okay. You know, and the KISS principle applies on the desktop experience as well. You know, I read some really interesting research that Nielsen Norman did about teenagers. You know, it seems to fly in the face of what you might think. They're not all mega uber web savvy techno geeks. Some of them do struggle with, you know, surfing and the inconsistencies of the UI and that sort of thing. And they aren't after clutter. They aren't after glitz and bling. They want cut down. So, you know, there's no audience necessarily, apart from perhaps the people in this room as an exception, who want the uber geek experience. They want something that's really cut down. So depending on what your main site is, it might be fine. And responsive design means that it will... Somebody just tweeted. It might be fine to just have that as the main site and use responsive design, make sure that the images that are served up, because a lot of screen readers, for example, don't start reading on the page until the full page has been rendered, because then they take the full source code and virtualize it. So if you've got 3 embedded Flash objects, 68 images that haven't been compressed, you know, haven't been made mobile optimized, then it could, I mean, it takes, I'm going to talk about Google Project Glass in a minute. And The Verge, Joshua Topolsky, spent a day with Google Glass. We've got to get onto that.
We will, it's all right.
And The Verge, the website, is supposed to be super sexy, I don't know, but it took 2.5 minutes for the page to start speaking to me. Because I don't know what's on it. I mean, I didn't get very far. After 2.5 minutes of waiting, then it rendered it in the virtual buffer. And I could then hit H, and thankfully, you know, it did take me down to the first heading, which was the top of the article, about him spending a day at Google. But then underneath that heading, you've still got about 20 odd individual lines of sharing, you know, share on Twitter, share on plus one, you know, like this, center, whatever. So, and that's actually quite a common occurrence. You wouldn't get anything like that on a mobile experience.
I want to get to Google Glass, because Google Glass and driverless cars and stuff like that, it's all very geeky and I get very excited about it. But before we do, I've got one kind of follow-up question with that. Which somebody has suggested actually, on something like the Verge site, what about if you pumped it through something like Readability or Instapaper? Does that help? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Right. In fact, in the days of yore, where there were only desktop versions, I would often look for a print link. Because that strips out the ads, it strips out the sharing. Well, there wasn't social back then. I mean, I would still look for that. In fact, I did on the Verge site, they didn't have one.
Right.
So, but yes, I would. And similarly on Safari, I would go for the reader
option.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Anything that strips out the meat, because what might be peripheral, eye candy or clutter for you, for me, if it's in the source code prior, before the article, I have to plow.
So again, that kind of goes back to what you're saying about, stuff that maybe is built for the mainstream actually helps everybody, because we want Instapaper and readability for the same reasons you do, really, to get rid of the clutter and to get rid of all of the extra stuff we don't care about. So this principle of building technologies that actually works for everyone is just so great, which I guess is what Google Glass is. About as well. So do you want to talk us, why are you so excited about Google? Because Google Glass is a heads-up display. Why on earth would you care about a heads-up display?
While we're talking about it, we could run a... we haven't got any sound on the videos, have we? So we can talk and they can...
The video's running behind you.
Okay, so smartness is really, this the platform that we've got here and the sort of technology that can be miniaturized into Google Glasses, for example, which are a reality, by the way. They are going to be coming to market certainly by the end of the year, but if you have a look on the Verge website, you can see a video of him using the versions that are out and about at the moment. The smartness helps people who have limitations of some sort or another. Mm-hmm. So Siri, for example, it's a nicety, but for me, it can save whole minutes, whereas for you, it might save whole seconds or a minute, perhaps, to get to a bit of information that you want or to create an appointment or whatever. For me, that 2.5 minutes on the Verge, if I was after a bit of information, I could maybe have got something from Siri in 2.5 seconds. Or,
yeah.
Well, what, Siri, sometimes it can be 2.5 minutes. But anyway, but something like this, the smartness that we've got here, I could show you an app on here, which if I just put a piece of money underneath, then the camera, you're asking about why it's useful. There are so many times I'm using the camera just to see if I've switched the lights off. There's a free app called Light Detector, and it can tell you with a tone how much light there is in the room, and
brilliant.
That's a good way, if all the other family have gone to bed, to make sure that the lights are off. Or my monitor, I don't have the monitor switched on, but it's a family computer, so I don't want to waste electricity, I'll just see if the monitor's on or off,
right,
using Light Detector. There's another one, where Money Reader, where you can detect some notes, and you don't even have to take a photograph, you just wave it over the money. And that's the sort of technology that we're seeing in Google Glass, or Project Glass. There is a camera built in there, it's always looking where you're looking, and what would a blind person want more than a camera with intelligence behind it that can do object recognition, that has GPS built in, that can tell you where you are, it's got a heads-up display, but this is going back to what I was talking about before, choices. If you've got redundancy, if you've got text on the screen, but it'll also have speech, it will speak it back to you. If there are Braille drivers, which there are in iOS, to drive a Braille display, then...
Tweet list.
Somebody else has tweeted. Then you don't have to even be able to see or hear to use an iOS device, because you can input it from touch, from typing on a Bluetooth keyboard, and they've got good touch typing skills, and it can drive a Braille display. So you can be deaf blind and still use one of these. So it's all about choices and extensibility. You can drive the whole of an iPhone from a single switch with a Bluetooth and the on-screen keyboard, and it's completely switch operable. So here, even though a blind person, for example, can't use the heads-up display, because it's been designed to have redundancy, it can also speak back to you, and we could hear that if it was saying, so it can read to you your text messages. If you're doing a Google Hangout, it will, speak what the other person is saying on the other end.
Right.
So it's got that capability to talk to you. And that's all I need as a blind person. I've got a camera built in, I can use object recognition to look at a QR code or to look at a building and tell me what it is, and forget the heads-up display, it'll speak it back to me. So that's the sort of promise of Project Glass. For people with a range of other impairments, because I've been talking about vision because that's me, but in AbilityNet we're right across the spectrum. So
yeah.
Imagine somebody who is hard of hearing. You've got real-time voice recognition, we know that, and there are apps that will do that. Obviously Siri does it, but there are apps that will do it real-time until you tell it to stop. So for someone with a hearing impairment, combine the microphone that can tell, that can listen to people talking with a heads-up display, you've got real-time subtitling for people who can't hear at all. We could run another video of showing emotion recognition, for example, and that's
really?
Very mature technology as well. In fact, in tests, 56% of the time, humans guessed the emotion correctly in a range of facial expressions, and this software got 65%, right? So put that in the camera in Google Glass, or rather, you know, use the camera and put the software in. And for people with autism,
I was about to say,
it will tell you on the heads-up display, stop talking, this person's getting cross.
Yeah.
You know? So there are so many applications for people with a range of impairments, and these are all byproducts of this, you know, the fact that it is inclusive design. It's designing for the as close to 100% as possible.
Wonderful. And well, we want to take some questions directly from the audience, but before we do that, I have one final and very important question to ask you, which is, are you going to buy a driverless car when Google release them?
If AbilityNet will pay.
Good answer.
But seriously, I would pay an extra 10K on top of the price of a family car, because, you know, that's another brilliant example. I don't know if that's running.
I suppose it can be. Somebody can run that.
So
yeah, it's going.
In Nevada, they're now licensed to drive driverless cars. They've been driving around America for the last 3 years now, and they've never had a crash. There's someone sitting in the driver's seat. This is the Google Street View cars, but they've actually been using it as a good opportunity to sort of mature the technology for autonomous driving. And they've never had a crash. And now in Berlin, there's a fleet of taxis that are driverless. And I think this is showing someone calling it on their iPad. And again, you know, it's a perfect example. It's obviously for people that don't want cars, or that, you know, aren't able to park, so they tell it to go and park half a mile away. So it's obviously got mainstream, and I'm sure that's the driver. It's not disability. But because it's inclusive, or rather, you know, if they do it right, it'll be inclusive, then the app that you use to call it will be coded accessibly. You know, when you get in, not only does it go along, but for someone like myself, it'll tell you where you are and when you've arrived. Because otherwise, if it just stops and it doesn't tell me we're there, I'll get out at a traffic light. You know, I don't want to do that. So, yeah, so, and obviously, you know, you'd have some of the fleet that were wheelchair accessible, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So consider diverse personas the whole way through, and you're much more likely to get up to the 90s, high 90s, right towards that 100% inclusive.
That's brilliant. We are living in the future. It's scary. Okay. Thank you so much. I don't want to because your dog has fallen asleep. He's so happy. Oh, I'm sorry. I woke you up. Okay. Say it. Big round of applause. The dog's awake. Big round of applause for the dog.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.